Welcome to SCOTUScast, Voluntariness and Admissibility Post-Decision Edition. Thanks for tuning in. On Monday, April 6th, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Corley v. United States, and on Wednesday, April 29th, it announced its decision in Kansas v. Ventress. In Ventress, the Supreme Court considered whether a criminal defendant's voluntary admission, elicited in violation of his right to counsel, is admissible at trial for the purpose of impeaching his testimony. And in a 7-2 decision delivered by Justice Scalia, the court held that it is, reversing the Kansas Supreme Court decision below. In Corley, the court considered whether a voluntary confession must be suppressed if it was taken in violation of the prompt presentment requirement, and in a 5-4 decision delivered by Justice Souter, the court held that it must indeed be suppressed, vacating the Third Circuit opinion below. To discuss these decisions, we welcome Aiken Gump Strauss Hauer and Feld partner Tom Goldstein. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Goldstein.
Well, it's such a pleasure to have the opportunity to do this podcast with the Federalist Society, which I really think is the nation's most valuable legal organization. It has been a fantastic group, always open to wide-ranging discussions and opposing points of view, and a fantastic forum for learning about developments in the law and thinking about cutting-edge issues. The two cases that I'm going to talk about in this podcast have, as their common theme, remedies in particular for violations of criminal procedure-type rights. In the first case, Kansas versus Ventress, involves the remedy for a violation of the right to counsel. And in fact, the real dispute in the case is whether it's a remedies case at all or a case about violating rights. So what happened is that two individuals had a sort of misguided scheme, it seems, to go and confront someone that had been rumored to be a child molester and also was thought to have some money. And they ended up, it turns out, shooting the person. But which of the two of them did it was a real question. The police arrested both. One immediately pointed the finger at the other. And the other, Ventress, was being kept in a holding cell or in a prison cell. And the government sent in an informant. They said, just listen to what he has to say. And at one point, the informant said, oh, you seem to have something weighing on your mind. And Ventress then tells the story of how he shot the victim. At trial, the prosecution didn't try and introduce testimony from the informant, and that's because the informant's conduct, the prosecution conceded, violated the so-called Messiah right, which is they already had suspected Ventress. And yet, while he was in prison, they tried to elicit information from him through the informant without the benefit of his counsel. So they recognized that they weren't supposed to introduce the informant's testimony in the direct case against Ventress. But after the other individual, the one who had pointed the finger at him, took the stand and said he had done it, Ventress himself decided to testify. And he said, no, it was her. It wasn't me. And so both were pointing fingers at each other, and the prosecution said, at this point, we're going to introduce the informant's testimony that Ventress essentially confessed. And that raised the question, what is the remedy for a violation of the Messiah right? And in fact, what is the violation of the Messiah right? Is it just when the informant went in and elicited this information? Or is the right violated when the testimony is introduced at trial, whether in direct examination or, as here, in impeachment? And if the violation is when the statements were elicited, should there nonetheless be a remedy that says you can't ever introduce it at trial? And the way the Supreme Court resolved this question in a 7-2 decision was to say that the violation here was when the informant elicited the information. That's when Ventress's right to counsel was violated, and the bar to introducing that testimony at trial is purely prophylactic. Like there's an exclusionary rule for the Fourth Amendment, so too there is an exclusionary rule for the Sixth Amendment. If testimony is elicited in violation of your right to counsel, it can't be introduced in the direct examination, in the prosecution's direct case. But the Supreme Court said, just as in the Fourth Amendment case, evidence seized unconstitutionally in violation of the Fourth Amendment can be introduced for impeachment purposes, so too can evidence that is elicited in violation of the Sixth Amendment, because when it comes to these sorts of prophylactic remedies, like the exclusionary rule, you have to balance the costs and the benefits. And here, the Supreme Court said, the cost of excluding it for impeachment is too great. It interferes too much with the search for truth. But there is very little benefit because the Sixth Amendment right is sufficiently protected by the prosecution knowing it can't introduce the evidence in its direct case. So only Justice Stevens and Justice Ginsburg dissented. They would have found that the introduction of the evidence itself violated the Sixth Amendment, but they were in a small minority. And lessons that I think you can derive from this case are the Supreme Court is moving in the direction of narrowing the exclusionary rule and other prophylactic remedies and conceiving of the violations as occurring much earlier in the process, whether it's the unconstitutional seizure of evidence in violation of the Fourth Amendment, getting the testimony in violation of the Sixth Amendment, and then narrowing the remedies. And that, too, is part of a broader trend in the Supreme Court of recognizing rights but being more hesitant to recognize remedies for those violations, particularly remedies that would interfere with the prosecution of criminal cases and the search for truth. They were not going to let Ventress escape responsibility for his crimes. The second case, Corley versus United States, is another remedies case, but this is not about the remedy that is implied so much as it is how it is that you interpret a federal statute. So it starts with Rule 5 of the Rules of Criminal Procedure, which says that you have to take a defendant and someone who's been arrested without unnecessary delay to a magistrate judge. And before the magistrate, the defendant learns the charges that are against him. And applying Rule 5, the Supreme Court in cases called McNabb and Mallory gave rise to what's known as the McNabb-Mallory Rule. And it says that if the police violate the prompt presentment requirement of Rule 5, then confessions that they do get before they take a defendant to the magistrate are generally inadmissible. Well, Congress, in the wake of McNabb-Mallory and in the wake of Miranda, passed a statute called Section 3501, and it was intended to overrule Miranda and McNabb-Mallory in part, and this is a case about how big the part is. So to put it in the context of the facts of this case, the FBI arrests a guy for assaulting a federal officer at 8 a.m. one day. He's then taken to the hospital because he has a minor injury, and he's returned to the FBI office at 3:30, and at about 5:30, which is 9.5 hours after his arrest, he begins confessing. And then he takes a break and finishes his confession the next morning. Now, that would be a non-prompt presentment to a magistrate judge. But Section 3501 has two provisions. And it says in subsection A that if a confession is voluntary, it's admissible. And in subsection C, that if it's voluntary and it occurs within 6 hours, unless certain exceptions are met that extend the time, it's admissible. And so the Supreme Court in the Corley case was confronted with the puzzling disconnect between subsections A and C. The A section just requires that it be voluntary. Subsection C also requires that it generally occur within 6 hours, and this confession did not. And the Supreme Court, by a very narrow 5-4 majority in an opinion by Justice Souter, joined by Justice Stevens, Kennedy, Ginsburg, and Breyer, so Kennedy coming over one of 5 times this term with the more liberal justices, said, look, subsection A, the rule of voluntariness, was intended to address Miranda. It's subsection C that's intended to address McNabb-Mallory, and all that Section 3501 does in this context is sets a baseline that if you violate the prompt presentment requirement, if you nonetheless bring the defendant in to a magistrate within 6 hours, unless one of the exceptions is met, then the confession is admissible. The majority, unlike the dissent, rejects the argument that it's merely sufficient that the confession be voluntary and refuses to adopt a voluntariness standard for the admission of all confessions, whether they violate Miranda or instead violate the McNabb-Mallory prompt presentment rule. So it's a very closely divided case. It's mostly a case about statutory construction, but you can tell that the court's more liberal justices are inclined to construe Section 3501 in a way that favors defendants, that favors excluding confessions, and trying to hold the government to Rule 5, whereas the more conservative members of the court in dissent are more inclined to give a narrow reading to the exclusionary remedy that's announced in McNabb-Mallory to give the prosecution a freer hand. But ultimately, this ends up being a question about how to interpret the statute, and there's no doubt that Congress could come along and pass another law. So Candace versus Ventris and Corley versus the United States sort of contrast in their outcomes. One, Kansas versus Ventris narrowly construes a remedy. In Corley, by contrast, a slim majority of the court comes along and more broadly reads the remedy and narrowly reads Congress's enactment in Section 3501.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video from past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.